the calcium was indigenous in soil. So the calcium was indigenous as a calcium carbonate for the pristine surface and subsurface soil. From the calcium carbonate may be all the exchangeable site. However, in Windsor soil, we can find the calcium as exchangeable. Only this indigenous or the initial concentration, which was in the soil itself. The cadmium work to compete it and take its place in the soil from the exchangeable or interact in the calcium carbonate and get it out. And there's a lot of publication talk about the cadmium replacement for the calcium in the calcium carbonate mineral.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the very last speaker of this session is Carlos Ochoa from New Mexico State.
Well, thank you all for staying. I was gonna, I changed the title a little bit from what is in that in the book there. Basically, it's just deep percolation in the groundwater level response following flood irrigation. In this case, by flood, I mean surface irrigation, border type. And this is this valley here. This is typical of northern New Mexico and pretty much throughout the southwest, the semi-desert part there. This is the Rio Grande. Most of the flow there comes from the snow melting from the lower part of Colorado and the mountains there. So as you can see, semi-desert areas, these green swaths are oases for us right there, so we need to preserve them somehow. And this irrigation dish that you see there, this is what they call a traditional irrigation system, also known as a sequía, from the Spanish word sequía. And this kind of technology came with the Spaniards back in the 1600s, and it basically helps irrigate in these valleys. As you can see, comes off the main stem of the Rio Grande, irrigate the valley, and goes back to the river. So it's kind of like a transition canal, and most of the valley is irrigated there. And so I'm just going to describe kind of the soil's condition there that we've been analyzing. This is part of a much broader and bigger project where we're this basically started with some funding from the NRI, from the USDA CSREES, where the idea was to study the effects of the Rio Grande flow in irrigated valleys in northern New Mexico. And this is kind of like the first valley we started looking at. This is what is called the Alcalde Velarde Ridge there in northern New Mexico. And here we have the New Mexico State University has a branch station there. And luckily for us, it's between one of these main irrigation canals and the river right there. So we have this pretty nice interaction with irrigation and the river interactions there. And when you guys were talking about modeling and scales, here the idea since the beginning when we started this project was to do a multi-model, multi-scale approach for this here, with the idea that here at the station, here the science center, we will do experimental plots, then field scale studies. We will couple field measurements. We will use those field measurements to parameterize models. I mean, models are great, but you need to adequately parameterize the model so in a way you have good results. Otherwise, you're gonna have a bunch of pretty nice artificial numbers out of that. So that was kind of the approach there. And then the idea, here we're using models like Roots on Water Quality Model. We're using models like Hydrus for the plot scale and field scale. Then we're building this system dynamics model that we have for the entire valley and the basin scale. And also we're using mold flow to kind of use parameterized models at the process scale, if you want to call it that way. And then we have these gray boxes that kind of lead us into the system dynamics model that is nothing else but a black box type of model where, I mean, it's the broader you get into the scale, the harder it gets to really parameterize and adequately characterize physical processes there. Anyway, that's kind of the general picture there. So in this case, I'm just going to focus on what happens in two particular soils there. And these are basically, I need to go back this. And then this science center, we've been doing the deep percolation studies since 2004. We started with an alfalfa field and in a sandy loam soil. And back then we have a 15 to 62% deep percolation below the upper 1 meter root zone. In that case, we define the upper 1 meter as the main rooting system, because alfalfa even can go deeper as 5 meters or more. 70% of the roots are pretty much within the first 1 meter. So in that case, we have a 15 to 60%. Then we did that same study in an apple orchard there, the photo you see on the right side, and we have up to 40%. We apply about 12 irrigation different depths, and in all of them we have a response from the aquifer there. As you can see on this graph here, for the alfalfa field, one particular irrigation, we have up to 35 centimeters of aquifer response. So it was the connection with surface water and groundwater was like very well explicit in this particular, in these two fields, as a matter of fact. We think the reason that is because we have these deep rooting crops. Most of these crops were like 8 years old or more, and then most likely they already have this well developed macropore flow that influence all that water going through the system. So based on that, we say, well, let's go and try something new. Let's try with kind of similar soils, but with a different perspective, new crop, not that deep rooted crop, and let's see how they behave to the previous results we already had. So basically, the approach is pretty much the same. We still kept the 1 meter here, even it was in this case it's a grass and oat mix, and most of the roots stay in the upper 20, 30 centimeters. But in this case, you just want to try to represent what we already had. But also, previous results in these two soils showed we did at the plot scale, and that data is already published in the VetoZone Journal, on the special edition that the Unsaturated Zone Interest Group published in May, June, more or less, I think. So that if you are interested in, you know, the previous results of this study, they are already published there. This is kind of like the follow-up of that study. So these are the three main objectives for this part here. Determine deep percolation for these soils, assess the roots and water quality model performance, and characterizes the groundwater level response for this. So this is kind of the experimental field. Here's the Alcalde main irrigation ditch. Here's the two fields. One is a sandy loam, and the other one is a clay loam. This is the Werlo series, and this is the Fruitland series and the Werlo series. Like I said in the beginning, we have these 12 by 12 meters plots, and we expanded into these 100 by 100 meter fields. The water table fluctuates in the clay loam from 2.8 meters to 4 meters, so it's very shallow. And we apply surface irrigation, and the cover crop, we call it a cover crop, is we were not really interested in the crop, was used mostly some vegetation to put there. It's an arts and grass mix. And the parameters, we wanted to measure irrigation depth, the moisture content, how much water runs up the field, and in general, the water level response to this. So this is kind of the methods we use. We use a daily water balance method based on field measurements to calculate deep percolation, where deep percolation is the soil water content initially, on average, plus the irrigation depth, plus precipitation, plus field capacity, soil water content and field capacity, in this case defined as the 24 hours after irrigation apply, minus the runoff, and minus ET for the day. Then that was for the field measurements base. Then we use the roots and water quality model. This is a model for those of you that are not familiar with. The USDA ARS up in Fort Collins, Colorado, Lash Ahuya and collaborators developed this model. We used it successfully for the alfalfa part, so we thought it was going to work good as well for this one. So this is kind of the model. We use the minimum input part in the model. It's basically you just enter the crop information, climate data, soil, and the irrigation apply. And in this case, we were only interested in the deep percolation. The model can simulate a bunch of other different things, but we were not interested in that. So this is kind of like a schematic of the field data collection. This part here and this part here used to be the previous 12 by 12 meter plots. So all we did is added a new station right here, one well here and some moisture station here. We put the wells on the outer part to see what was the response out there. We measured the inflow water in the field with this propeller flow meter. This is kind of like the flow there. And we also measured the amount of water running off the field. And the slope is about 1 meter. So this is kind of like a real life, how it looks, more or less, one of these fields. In these cases, when they were planting the crop. Here's some of the instrumentation we use, the propeller flow meter. We apply 12 irrigations. We two irrigation seasons, 2008 and 2009. The irrigation depth fluctuated from 4 to 22 centimeters. I mean, actually, 26, I think, was. That's not right. And the field runoff, we use this Samani Magallani flow meter. We attach a as you can see there, it's a pressure transducer to measure depth. And then we calibrate the flow passing through there using an acoustic Doppler meter, just to be sure that the equation was correct. And we apply irrigation using a 6-inch diameter aluminum pipe to the field. This is from the previous plots experiment that we did. Of course, this is, it was like almost 2 years ago. This was, the soil has already been repacked. And so this, don't get biased, but this is not, we are not doing preferential flow here. So basically, I'm showing this just to illustrate the way we instrumented the, we put the sensors and the soil profiles here. This is for the clay loam, and this is for the sandy loam. And here you can see that the differences in soils. So we have a sensor right there and a sensor over there. And it was, we started with a 10 centimeters depth right there, and we went half meter all the way down to the water table in this case.
How deep was the water table?
2.8 meters in one of the soils and 4 meters in the other soil. This is at the start of the irrigation season. It went up to 3 feet more or less during the irrigation. So some of the results are here for the deep percolation based on field measurements. We only observed deep percolation in 4 out of 12 irrigations, and they were relatively low. We were expecting more than that based on what we had in the alfalfa field, and we only have up to 27% more or less. And but in the clay loam soil, contrary to what we expected, we have up to 70% percolation, 74% percolation. But in this case, we attributed that to the water content, the initial water content. It was already pretty much wet, pretty close to field capacity, as you can notice there. So those three first irrigations, we have some pretty heavy rains before irrigation was applied, so the soil was already pretty wet. So it was easy for the water just to penetrate below the root zone. But only, once again, we only observed percolation in 3 out of 12 irrigation events. So it was kind of a disappointing for us because we were expecting a bunch of water flowing through so we could characterize the entire thing. And it was one of those experiments that you expect something else. So in terms of the model, we have kind of mixed results here. Some of them were pretty close, some others were not. I think the model itself is a fair agreement, considering that we're talking here average conditions. So for the model, it's kind of hard to characterize. It's a one-dimensional model. Here we're talking about a two-dimensional or three-dimensional field, which is pretty hard to characterize. But in general, we think it did a decent job. I think we can calibrate it better and make it work properly for this application. In terms of water level response for the clay loam soil, we observed up to 16 centimeters in the highest irrigation applied of 23 centimeters. This is the three inner wells there. You can see the south, the midfield, and the north well. they more or less behave the same, although some of, in some occasions you have more response in one well versus the other. That might be some preferential flow there also. In terms of the sandy loam, I'm just illustrating just one well here because we barely had any response. We only up to 2 centimeters when we had any response. And just to, for illustration purposes here, the 3 wells in the sandy loam, as you can see, is a muted response, so barely any response from that soil. Now, the conclusions are that regardless of the soil type in this case, deep percolation was only observed after a few irrigations. But the higher antecedent soil moisture in the shallow water table contributed to the greater deep percolation in the clay loam soil, which I said is 2.8 meters versus the other one, which is 4 meters. We think it's a fair agreement between simulated and field measure-based deep percolation. And then in general, the lower water level rise and the longer time response was observed in this particular experiment when compared to previous results that we have from some other studies. So that's pretty much it. So I try to make it short. Any questions?
Maybe one quick question.
Yes, sir.
Your approach seems to be that the water balance approach is the accurate one, you know, model being compared to that. In the water balance approach, you're using soil water content and field capacity. How do you estimate that?
In this case, we're just using the upper 1 meter field capacity, and I said 24 hours after the end of the irrigation. That was kind of, that's how much it's assumptions in both.
But I mean, are you taking the measured value that you saw of water content?
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Once we saturated the soil. So some other times the entire profile didn't get saturated, we probably have less than saturation after.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that will conclude this session. Okay, thank you everybody for staying up in late afternoon. Okay, I see Jakob here. I believe like a business meeting is coming up in a few minutes. Okay.
Get this room.
It's been great.
Yeah.
We're just apparently better than everybody else.
Yeah, I guess so. I haven't seen anything else. So, are you ready for the meeting? I'll start off recognition service. And then I can stay around for a little while. I have a meeting at 6 o'clock. I need to hire a consultation team. So I can be around maybe till 5:30 or so.
I owe you one. You guys are cool.
Yeah. I guess we'll try to start. And the first question is there anybody who doesn't have minutes and agenda? So just raise your hand and we'll dispatch minutes and agenda to this person. Okay. Okay, let's start the business meeting of the Division S1 of the Soil Science Society of America. So, first question, everybody has agenda and minutes, looks like. Now, I'll just follow agenda. I didn't put it on the screen since it's on the paper already. My name is Jakub Poczewski. I am past chair of the S1. And I'm supposed to run this meeting, and then we'll get another chair. So division officers at this point are Per Moldrup. He's a past chair. He couldn't come to this meeting because of the teaching obligations, but he sent the hellos and good wishes for this meeting. Now, the incoming chair is Ty Ferre. Ty, could you... He can. That's good. Now, the chair-elect is Michael Young. Mike, could you show up? Yeah, thanks. And David Ratcliffe is our S1 representative and the board of the society. And Bob Horton, I guess he's not here. What does it mean? I mean, you are not Bob Horton, for God's sake. Yeah. Right. So he represents us in the rapid response team. First matter of the order is the announcement, and we have two candidates for the S1 incoming chair elect, and those are Tim Green, USDA ARS. Is Tim here? No, but okay, that's good. So you can, well, he doesn't need to stand up, everybody can see him, that's good. And another candidate is Ole Vendroth from University of Kentucky. Ole, could you? Thanks. And we didn't do any other elections this year, unless we will decide to do something with the early career, but we'll discuss it later. Now, the third matter of order is the approval of minutes from 2007 business meeting. Ah, I forgot to mention one thing. The president of the Soil Science Society of America, Paul Bursch, is here. So.
Actually.
Yeah, Paul?
I'd like to take this opportunity to present Jakob with a plaque of our, showing our, we're quite pleased to, for all the work that you did as the S1 chair this year. Those of you that have not done that, it's quite a bit involved in terms of putting meetings together, doing the planning for this meeting, and I've heard a lot of good things about what's going on in S1. I'm really impressed with this room that you got. I didn't see anything like it throughout the rest of the facility. So, but I'd really like to take this opportunity to thank you for your hard work.
Thank you.
you know, there's a number of divisions that seem to be a little bit more active than others, and this certainly is one of them. And I think the attendance here at the business meeting is testimony to all of the activities within the division. And I think this is really important to have strong divisions, have good programming, and to continue to work together. And the other thing I'd like to do is to recognize David Radcliffe, who's your board member. David is a really hardworking board member. I can always rely on him because there are times when I need to get certain board members to really step up, and David has been one of those. And really, all the board has been very active this year, extremely responsive. It's allowed us to really move forward on a lot of areas that David will be talking to you about a little bit later. I'm going to have to run out. What's that?
I'll eat a beer.
Yeah. I'm going to have to run out to another meeting. We have a conference call with some folks out in California here in a bit. But I just wanted to thank David and congratulate you for all your work.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
What happened to the 2008 business meeting?
2008 business meeting became a misprint, right? It's a misprint. Now, we actually need to approve minutes of the 2008 business meeting, and what you have is our 2008 business meeting minutes. So let's go to this process of approval. I need one approval voice. Is anybody for approval of this one? Needs to be seconded. So who is for the approval of the minutes, please raise your hands. Who is against? Who is abstained? Okay. Univocal. Okay, that sounds good. Now, the award recipients and fellows, that was a good year. Well, the Soul Physics Award, Don and Betty Kerham Soul Physics Award, went to Keith Bristow. Where is Keith? And the Soul Physics Applied Research Award went to Scott Yates. We have new Society of America Fellows, Teferi Tsigaye. He is around, but he's not here. And Ole. So that's great. And we also have a new ASA Fellow, Lao Shen Wu, which is great. I must say that the competition from year to year in this business becomes more and more tough. So these recipients, they really went through the serious competition. And it's all well deserved, of course. Now, division awards and recognition. Well, you know that we have this S1 Early Career Award. And this year, committee was... I guess I'll let Mike to tell everything about this award because it's important award. Mike, if you could.
Maybe. Let me try.
What do you want to do?
Lights.
Thanks, Yakov. For the last year, I've been the chair of the S1 Early Career Award Committee, which was also with Dave Robinson, myself, Yakov, and Per Muldrup as the ex-chair. And we had really an excellent group of candidates this year. We had a total of six candidates. The restriction is, which I'll discuss in a second, for folks who have basically made outstanding contributions in soil physics within 6 years of completing their PhD degree. And there's a little bit of ambiguity in there, but it's really with great pleasure that And I'll sort of describe this first here, that to award this to Tyson Ochsner at Oklahoma State. Tyson has graduated from Iowa State. He then went to USD ARS in Minnesota. In St. Paul, he's now an assistant professor at Oklahoma State. He specializes in theoretical and applied aspects of soil thermal properties, including sensor development and data analysis. And he's done a lot of work in looking, simultaneously measuring soil electrical and thermal properties for determining volumetric fractions of the different phases in the soil. And it's really a great pleasure to award this to him. Unfortunately, he's on his way back to Oklahoma to teach. But Mandy Leach is here to accept this in his behalf.
He's a good boss. What can I say?
Now there is one issue that I guess I can bring up here, or we can just do this through email, or we can just do it by decree.
Yeah, let's.
And that has to do with the way that the award is written right now. There's an ambiguity in the description of the restriction, because it describes the need for a person who completed their PhD within 6 years, but it doesn't really make a distinction between whether it's a graduation date, whether it's the defense date, whether it's the acceptance by the grad department. And in this particular year, we had that posed us some problems. And what I would like to suggest is that we make this really unambiguous by suggesting that the year that a person graduates and completes the degree and it's accepted is the 6 year. So we're not really, so in other words, a person who graduates in May would still, 6 years and several months later, would still be able to apply, even if it's September of that year, if you understand me correctly. And
the year of the award,
that's right, exactly. This way, there's no question anymore about completion of the degree, graduation, or acceptance. And so any year the person completes, they would be eligible 6 years after. Is that something that would be more or less clear, I think? And it would certainly help, I think, the committees to, the future committees to deal with this.
And why the number six?
You know, I don't know. Seventh year sabbatical. Well, maybe so. Yeah, seventh year is probably if somebody goes up for tenure, I guess. I'm not sure why that came up. Okay, the year the degree was awarded. All right, that's pretty clear. Is everybody's okay with that? Okay, that way we don't have to worry about sort of crossing over into different years. So I'd like to move. I'll rewrite this, but if I'd like to just see if everybody's okay. Do we have a motion? I guess we have to have a motion, right? And
so moved.
Second. All approved. The discussion? Yeah. Motion passes. Okay. And I would like to mention also that David Robinson will be the incoming chair, and Ole Wendroth is the incoming member of the Early Career Award. Okay? Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. That was good.
Now, we're getting to the business thing, and the first thing is Soil Science Society of America Journal editorial board report. And Glenn Wilson, as the S1 technical editor, is going to tell us what's going on with this.
I'll try to make it quick. The journal's doing very well. Matter of fact, I have handouts if you want them before you leave. I'm not going to hand them out. If you want them, you can get them.
Glenn, just use this thing.
Just come up here with camera.
Journal's still doing very well. We're increased in number of submissions for the journal as a whole. We're going to be close to 500 this year. And S1 has increased this year over last year. We're staying pretty even with what we were the previous few years. Doing really well still as far as quality. Number one in citations out of the 31 in our area. Number five in impact factor. This year, I would like to acknowledge two of the members who are going off the board who've served two terms, Taurus Girk and Daniel Jimenez. These are two of the best that we've had since I've been there, so I want to give them a hand of applause. Thank you for your service. Melanie Mays is staying on for a second term appointment, and we have coming on board Jay Jabro and Budiman Manassany. The really only changes in the journal have been, we went to a 21-day review period from, it's been 1 month. It's 3 months total in the review process, but when we send it out to you, the reviewers, we've moved to a 21-day, and already we have seen a decrease in the time in review of about 7 days, and whether the two are correlated or not, I don't know. Other changes, they're going to go to a publish ahead of print implemented this year, and I also want to make everyone aware that when you have your paper published, you can also upload supplemental materials. You could also have PDFs. In those PDFs could be your figures that are in color, which you're not printing them in color in the journal, or you could have videos, you could have data, you can have other materials with that, and I think we're not taking advantage of that, that's available. So I think that's all that I've got to say, unless there were questions.
Are there any questions for
you? All right, good.
Thanks.
Yeah, the journal really looks good. This year and the previous year, I mean, it works like a good machine. Now, the next one we have is,
let me see, what is it?
Soil Science Society of America board report, and this is David. Could you?
As Paul said, the board has really been really active in the last year. We have a fantastic staff now at the headquarters. I mean, they're a pretty lean and mean group. As far as the budget this year, I think, you know, we've been dealing with a downturn in terms of the economy, but we're pretty much on schedule to meet the budget this year, which we're projected $180,000 in the black, and I think we'll be on schedule. Of course, one of the really important things is attendance at the meeting, and I think we had budgeted to have as much as a 10% reduction and still be able to meet the budget, and I talked to Ellen this morning, and it's about less than 5% drop in attendance this year, so that's really, really good. It'll be interesting to see what happens next year. I think states are, you know, next year may be the worst year so far in terms of budgets. So it's important to try and attend the meetings. Long Beach, right, should be a very nice place to meet next year. As far as initiatives with the board, we've had kind of one setback and two positives I can think of. I want to briefly describe to you. The setback is the Smithsonian exhibit. It's a tremendous success. You know, they say the Smithsonian's been surprised at attendance, that more than they expected. But, Paul, you can correct me on any of these things. The next step in this was to let the exhibit travel. And we had to get funding to do that. We had a grant from
Nutrients for Life.
Nutrients for Life, $1.5 million grant. That. But museums have to sign up and they have to come up with quite a bit of money in order to have the exhibit travel to them. And we only had two cities sign up so far. And it's a hard time for museums now, I think, in every sense. And so Nutrients for Life decided to pull their $1.5 million grant. And so that pretty much killed this second phase. And so we're trying to come up with a plan B. Now we're trying to get control of the exhibit. It belongs to the Smithsonian as it is. There was some talk, you know, a really wonderful scenario would be if it went to Disney World, something like that. But at this point, it may be that the immediate step will be to get possession of the exhibit so that it belongs to the society. So that's been a setback. Two positives that I want to mention is the headquarters building. I don't know if you've ever been to 677 South Sego Road, but it is a tiny building, and everybody's just crammed in there. The conference room, to move into the conference room, you have to kind of squeeze between the chairs and the wall. So it's a tiny place, and we're doing more and more as the years go by. So a couple of years ago, there was a task group that looked at building a new building. And the budget came back on that, and it was an impossible task. We couldn't afford to do it. But so one of the positive things of this downturn in the economy, though, is that commercial real estate prices have been dropping. And so part of what the staff has been able to do was they identified a good opportunity on a building that I think is about 7 years old, that's in Madison. It's over near the airport, which is projected to be a good growth area. So it's pretty much been finalized that we're going to purchase that building. And I think it wouldn't have happened if SSSA hadn't taken the lead on it. I think CSSA and ASA were not sure whether they wanted to do that. They pushed real hard that it was a good opportunity. So basically, we're going to take a lot of our fixed income and invest in this building. And we'll probably get a good return on it. So we've really solved our space problem. A lot of things that are happening that make the budget work right now are we, instead of outsourcing a lot of things, we're insourcing. And we instead of sending papers to the Philippines and having to go back and forth several times to get the equation right, they're doing it all in-house. And so you see, you know, the SSSA format is different. Well, you know, we need to be able to store paper. There's a lot of people doing computer work, but we need space in order to make that all happen. So that's going to come to pass, that early next year the staff will move into this new building. The other positive thing, I think, is this grand challenge, and Paul's really kind of led the way on this. The feeling is, and I think there's been a number of emails from people like Michael Young, that maybe there's an opportunity right now to increase the funding level for soil science at the national level. And so Paul has spearheaded forming groups to put in proposals that will lead to additional funding. We've had this, one of the questions was, what are the grand challenges in your science? And so there's been a group to identify what are those issues, and maybe Ty can talk in a minute about, Ty's our rep, so if you have some ideas that you think this is a brilliant idea that should attract funding. And there are two proposals that have been prepared. One is for an NSF workshop to identify what are key areas that could attract funding. And the topic is the rhizosphere biodiversity, but Paul says this is a broad look at it, so it's not just biology, it's physics and chemistry too. The other one is a nutrient trading initiative proposal for a workshop that would be funded by USDA and hopefully lead to additional funding in this Office for Ecosystem Services. And so, Ty, you want to mention what you guys are doing?
We're meeting immediately after this meeting to discuss what we're going to do. So okay. Any ideas, get them to me now.
Have anybody considered the idea of carbon consultants?
The role of carbon in soils?
Yeah, carbon in soils is something we're already very active on.
No pun intended.
The Rhizosphere Science Initiative came out of a discussion I had with the director of geosciences at NSF, Tim Colleen. He was looking for ideas that would cut across the earth, soil sciences, and the biological sciences. And this idea of Rhizosphere Sciences was something that I saw as kind of new, pushing. I mean, people are working on it, but not in an integrated way. He got very interested in it, asked for a white paper, asked for a presentation, which I put together for him. He made the presentation to the director of NSF. They got all spun up over it and asked for a proposal for a workshop, which I put in through the SSSA. So the SSSA will be the organizer of the workshop for the National Science Foundation in this integrated area. And so it's, yes.
In terms of topics, I think we should be looking to the future in terms of an integrated soils model, soil process model, that describes the interaction between water, chemistry, microbiology. 20, 30 years ago, nobody cared about carbon. Now everybody wants to predict what's happening with carbon.
That's a great idea, and a group at Penn State has already put together a white paper that was submitted in the materials that we're discussing this evening. And so again, you know, I sent a letter out to all of the members, and I got a lot of feedback as what we're going to try to sort through. But they put together a very nice white paper specifically in this area in terms of informatics. How are we going to eco-informatics and putting all this information together and making developing models that can make reasonable predictions. So I can see that it's clearly going to emerge as an important problem.
Yes, then, Daniel?
Absolutely, and that's one of the big successes we had this year at the policy level, in our both at the in the House and the Senate. We had a workshop for staffers on carbon dynamics and the role of soil in carbon dynamics. We had about 125 members of the Senate staff attend that, and close to 200 on the House side. And they've asked us; they want us to come back and do it again because not everybody obviously worked on it. So there's a lot of interest in this, particularly with the cap and trade legislation that's working its way through.
Is that emphasized in the Smithsonian's?
Any more comments on this one? Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Dave, any questions for Dave?
Yeah,
yes, please.
One question. Yeah. It has to do with the Smithsonian, and I understand that there's a Soils Caucus in the House, and my question is, has anybody talked to the Soils Caucus to see if they might be able to route some money to SSSA to essentially buy this back, or to somehow help to plus up that $1.5 million that this foundation is providing? Because this is really kind of in the national interest. This is not a parochial problem. This is something that that exhibit could help a lot of people across the country and should be essentially recognized by Congress.
Yeah, you know, the political process, as you know, is pretty complicated. Getting someone to plus up a bill for a soils exhibit, I think, would be difficult. What we are doing, and it was actually about $600,000 that Nutrients to Life put in. The sites group within the Smithsonian went back to them and asked them for another $600,000, and that's when they got upset and pulled their money out. So there were some strategic mistakes on the part of the Smithsonian group. You know, some people believe that the Smithsonian has never had to deal with economic times like this, and so when they would go out and say, oh, we got an exhibit, everybody would sign up. And right now, people aren't signing up, and so it may be that their skills for really marketing things aren't as good as perhaps they should be. They used to be, you know, we're the Smithsonian, we have this, and it was pretty much automatic. And the economic downturn has had a huge influence on museums' budgets. You probably have seen this really not only in the museums and the sciences, but throughout the arts and everything else. It's been a really challenging time for them. And so that was a real problem. What we really hope to do is get, as David said, is get control of it. And we can do that. Number one, we're talking with another group within the Smithsonian to see if they can give it to us. They're looking at the legal issues there. Or we might have to buy it. I think once we have control of it and we develop a plan, and a lot of people have talked about these regional science centers, which actually in many ways are more impactful than the museums in terms of how many people they reach and they engage teachers to a much greater degree. And so we've talked about strategies. If we had a plan, we were pretty certain to go back to the Nutrients to Life with that plan. And I would feel confident that they would reconsider, because really their differences was with the Smithsonian, not with the society.
Anything else on this one?
One thing I want to ask you about, the plenary sessions starting the other sessions at 10, and then I went down to the exhibit hall this morning at 8 thinking I would
Danny? Any other suggestions on the usefulness of these meetings? Yeah?
For us to be able to have the flexibility to make our own decisions as to what meetings we go to instead of the society deciding for us.
And there may be some other issue that I don't know about, but I'll find out.
Yeah, there may be some overarching interest, but the way it is set now, we had a difficulty to complete the program, really, to put it into 3 days. Still we have these overlaps in terms of the posters and sessions, and because we're 6 hours, we're just eating away. And we had these plenary lectures before, and we have them now. The Johann Boomer is doing a lecture, but it's in a regular time, so you want to go there, you go. You don't want to go to another session. Right, anyway, the next thing is the Vedos Zone Journal editorial report. Jan, could you?
Well, Vedas Zone Journal is doing very well on all fronts. Subscriptions, number of papers submitted, impact factor, income, doing very well. Among other things, the journal was identified by Thomson Reuters as one of the rising stars as a new journal. So they identify looking at new journals in terms of, you know, their citations and so on. And so we were selected and we did a little interview, and so this gives us a little bit more publicity. The impact factor has been steady, so, and we had a discussion just prior to this meeting, so if you know the numbers, it's between 1.4 and 1.5 basically for the past 3 years since it came out, whereas which is good. But you know, if you follow it, and some of you might, you know, you see the other journals continues to rise, and so the question is, why is that? And you know, there is some strategizing and so on that probably other journals are doing, and maybe we don't do that as much. So anyway, there is some room for improvement in that, and so we had some discussions about that. One of the other things that we discussed was maybe we should consider the scope of the journal a little bit more, and maybe also looking for some other audiences. So what other sciences, related sciences, should we target? And so if you have any ideas, we had some ideas at that meeting, but maybe we should try to have some look at some other societies that might need a publication outlet that would fit the journal very well. One of which that was mentioned was geotechnical engineering was mentioned as maybe one of the group that could fit the journal very well. See what else. So the finances, you know, it's well, it's been, you know, we have been now 8 years, I believe, 4 plus 4, and so now this year officially we got, you know, we are now one of the strong journals of the society. And so we're going to probably hit a net income of about $100,000, which was, you know, which was for the Soil Science Society like a surprise that we would do so well, so quick. So because of that, we also discussed maybe to reinvest some of that money, and the society agreed that it might be a good idea in terms of to make the journal better, improve it, is maybe to reinvest and attract some other authors and other disciplines to the journal. So if you have any ideas about that, we welcome that as well. So we want to, you know, maybe start an campaign, you know, to and take it to a next stage. What else? Well, yeah, and then of course is the editorial board. So there has been some changes. Tisa left, who was one of the co-editors and as one of the editors for Water Resources Research. Susan Hubbard is on board already for a year or 2 years, and she continue. Harry Verheken, who was our liaison, graciously accepted to be one of the co-editors. So starting January 1, Harry will be one of the co-editors. We probably will be looking for another co-editor in the next half year or so, as well as some other associate editors. And then lastly, I've been serving as the editor now for 4 years, and you know, although I really enjoyed it very much, it was fun. It's at the same time, it's also, I think, time for somebody else and to take it to the next level, as I said. And Danny will, starting January 1, will be our new editor. So with that, I thank you. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah, don't leave. There is this question about the Kirkham Conference and the agenda. So could you give
the Kirkham Conference? Yes. Yeah, so we had the Kirkham Conference is every 4 years. So we had the Kirkham Conference the last time in 2008 in Davis, and at the time we verbally agreed with Brent Clothier that he would organize it. He would take the responsibility for the next conference in New Zealand, and as far as I know, that will stay that way. Based on my experience, it takes about 2 years to organize, so I guess it would be time to contact Brent and you know, find out what his plans are. So that's all I really have to say about that. You know, we plan on having a 2012 Kirkham Conference.
Any questions for Jan on this one?
No, David.
Here is the question.
Do you think with modern technology that for those people who can't attend Kirkham,
they're not able to? Yeah. Good question. Yeah. So and there was some bylaws, and who was part of that at the time? There was some bylaws written at the time, and we all know how heavily involved Dawn was at the time, that actually kind of prevented that a little bit. But since then, you know, we put it back on the table, and I think clearly Don agreed that this maybe to open it up more, and so the idea is to, I think one of the ideas was to have maybe a webinar type of format, or so that it will be online available for the whole community. So that's, I'm sorry. Yes, that's right. So, so that was kind of an interim step, I think. We did the recording. That's right. Thank you for reminding me. So we had all the presentations on the web. Yet, you know, it's sitting there. It probably still is there, but I think it would be more interesting if we had it online available, and maybe even be part of the discussion. I don't know what, you know, technologies there are, but.
Thank you. Yeah, here is a question.
Right.
That is a tremendous job. well, joint activities. There was some initiatives related to the Ecological Society of America, Geological Society of America. Is there anything on this one? Or we don't have? Yeah, Mike? We don't have anything. Okay. Now, S1 discussions and S1 email server. I took a liberty to put this thing on this one. I think we need to have some kind of a community resource for discussions and board for announcements and so on and so forth. What the society can do, they did the discussion for us, say. We started the discussion and they made a place where you can log in and go and see the discussion and write your own comments and so on. Now, but this thing is limited only for the people who are members of the society. And also, you need to be a member of S1 to get there, which doesn't make much sense. So currently, whatever I have, I had to send to the server, S1 server, as an email. And it's always an issue. I mean, do we want to send spam around? Some type of information is not interesting for everybody. Just a small subgroup of S1 people may be interested in this. So I had some hesitations in this one. So my suggestion essentially is just to ask Marcus
to put this type of communication line on our website, because the website is up, is active, is good. If we can use, if we can have there these usual sections with the threads, so you can follow one of those discussions or questions and so on and so forth, it might make life easier. And I had this preliminary talk with Marcus. Marcus says, yeah, that's in principle it's possible. I can't exclude that in the future the society will do something for, like that for all divisions, including us. But society is small, and they, by the definition or by the need, they will do big things. So that may happen that we just will be ahead the curve. But still, my experience of this year is that we need some kind of communication channel for the whole division. So Marco said that in principle it's possible. What I would like to ask you to do, send some kind of suggestions, what you would like to see at this website. It does not mean that everything you want to see will be there, but at least it will be clear what kind of things are expected. And if you could send this stuff to Ty, I guess at this point, then we could put up this thing fairly quickly. It will be really efficient. Otherwise, everything goes through this bottleneck of the S1 chair, and it's not really operative. So that's what my suggestion is on this one. If you have any other suggestions or comments on this thing right now, then just please tell them. Otherwise, just send to Ty what we think should be there. So it's more, it's a business, of course. Now, the program report. Program report, well, we are in the middle of the program. We had two symposiums this year that were organized by essentially Pete Schaus, Todd, Attila Nemes, Peter Wieringa, and Don. It was the Rhin Symposium to honor Rhin Svengenuchten Pact. And there was another symposium on the soil moisture and scale, so these things organized by the Robert Schwartz and Ole Wendroff and team. And we have a lot of sessions, and I must say that the most of sessions till now were going very well. I didn't see any empty sessions. I was just cruising and seeing what's going on, so that was really good. And I really would like to acknowledge the effort that all organizers, Sully with the Reiner here, Teferi Zagaya, Scott, Andrei Guber, David with the teaching thing, they put into this organization. It was a new thing for us, see? We never had this thing that somebody would organize session rather than the S1 chair. And they did this work, I think, brilliantly this year. I really would like to thank them. So that's incredible. The changes in submission numbers and scheduling, we are pretty much at the same level. We are at the level of 210 papers this year, and it happened that way that there was almost no need to move papers from the orals to the posters on backwards. I guess two papers were moved from the orals to the posters. Otherwise, everybody got the way of presentation he or she wanted. Now, the other announcements. Scott, if you could. Thank you. Any other announcements of the general interest? Okay, well, there are no announcements. And then the last thing I have to do, I have to pass the gavel. So if Ty, if you could come here.
Is there a real gavel?
No. No.
Of course not.
Excellent. Well, let's all thank Jakob.
And I just want to finish with two things. First of all, we need topical sessions and symposia. And these all have to be in fairly soon. So I'm going to also ask Marcus Fair, although I wasn't polite enough to ask him beforehand. I'm going to ask if he puts up a form or a way that you can actually suggest topics for symposia and for topical sessions on that website as well. I really would like to push us to have these appeal to more than S1. So to the degree possible, if you can find somebody else in another discipline to be one of the co-sponsors, even if it's not officially a co-sponsor, let's really make sure that we get as much integration started from S1 as we can. The other thing that I mentioned to Paul, and I think, again, we can start it here, just sort of a catchy thing, is let's call it the keyword campaign. So when you're writing your papers, and you're sitting there searching, you're like, what the hell am I going to put as my third keyword? Put soil science, right? Let's start getting this hits to soil science in ways that we can. If it's appropriate, it's not a soil science problem. But let's do as much as we can in as easy a way as we can to try to release it. Anything else? My name is unusual enough that if you just search it on the internet, you'll find my email address, but it's typeforay@gmail.com. So if you have anything, you need anything, please feel free.
I just want to make an announcement. My name is John Seaman. I'm on the incoming chair elect next year for S2 division. And at the S2 division planning meeting on Sunday, one of the things that was brought up was having a dual symposium, S1 and S2, on reactive transport modeling, trying to increase credibility for both sides, from physical physics and also from chemistry as well. And now with the limit on the number of symposia that you can have, I think you're allowed 2 half-days that we can combine and make a full day on this topic, and then both organizations would still have another one that they could completely, they could choose to schedule however those two divisions would want to schedule. The other thing that we really wanted to do is try to increase interest of people from, we want to bring in USGS people, DOE people, all the other areas that do a lot of work in this, to be represented, maybe get them to come to our meetings where they might not otherwise come. And the other thing that we had talked about is, I think if there will be some people from DOE and some people that work with RADs and some other environmental issues, I think that we could get some sponsorship that might help offset some of the costs from some of these companies that are really involved in the new nuclear renaissance. And I think just some of the ones from the Savannah Riverside that are the new contractors, I think that they may not come up with a lot of money, but I think that they would come up with some to offset some of the cost of running one of those symposia and doing it right.
And this is a very good example of this kind of cross S. And just because I'm on a roll for volunteering other people for things, I'd like to maybe volunteer you there to do something that along the lines of what you suggested for one of these grand challenges. Why don't we try to make this an all S? What is the status of modeling towards an integrated soil model? So if you are willing to sort of jump on that, or you'll volunteer somebody else to do that, then I'll be happy to do the coordination with the other S people and other people involved. But let's look beyond sort of what we've been doing in this one or maybe two sessions. All right, good. Thanks very much. Anything else? Adjourned.